This week, we're skipping ahead to Judges chapter 17 through 18. And that might seem strange, since we only studied chapter 1 last week. Why skip ahead to chapter 17? The book of Judges is mostly chronological. Mostly. But in the end of the book, starting with chapter 17, there are two stories from the time of the judges which we suppose are not chronological. The first is the story of Micah and the Danites. The second is the story of the war with Benjamin. And today, we're studying the story of Micah and the Danites because it is my expectation that putting it here, at the beginning of Judges, is the chronological place to put it. Last week, we discussed how the tribes were unable to conquer all of their lands. We mentioned particularly that the tribe of Dan failed to take any of their land at all. Today's story tells of Dan's response to that, which is that they went looking for another piece of land altogether. We also discussed last week that the people fell away from pure worship of God, and this story is an example of that. It helps to explain how idolatry crept in among the people and made a foothold. The story also mentions Moses' grandson, which, if he is a literal grandson and not some degree of great-grandson, would suggest that this story is close to the first generation of the book of Judges. But then, that's also presuming that this is a descendant of Moses at all. We'll discuss that when we get there. And in general, this story gives an idea of what life was like in the time of the judges. It was something of a Wild West. Today's story will show that, lacking a central enforcer of the laws sometimes went unenforced. Sometimes the group with the most men and the most weapons won out over the group with the better case. And with no one to ensure that the worship of God remained pure, well, the worship became impure. It was a time, as the story will tell us, when everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So we have here two chapters about a man named Micah, the idolatrous worship that he established, and how he came into conflict with the wandering tribe of Dan. It's an interesting story about a wild people living in wild times. It is a fairly long passage, and it is one that is dense with interesting ethical considerations, so in the interest of time, we'll be reserving comment on the lessons for a second part. Today, we'll be taking a close look at the text itself, and we'll hold the lessons for another day. So then, your passage is Judges 17 through 18, and I recommend that you pause and read it now. The story begins thus. Micah, an Ephraimite, stole some silver, 1,100 pieces of silver. Unfortunately, we don't know just how much silver this is because there's no weight listed for the silver. The King James presumes that these are 1,100 shekels, which was the standard weight at the time, but we don't know that for certain. It just so happens that, at the time when I'm writing this message, a shekel is worth about 10 U.S. paper dollars. So this theft was nothing to sneeze at. Micah had stolen about $11,000. That's about 3 or 4 months' wages for an average American. And he didn't just steal the money. He stole it from his mother. Even worse. His mother realized that the silver was gone, but didn't know who had taken it, and so she cursed the thief, inadvertently cursing her own son thereby. So right from the start, this Micah is just about the worst kind of person. He's a thief, a violator of the commandment to honor his mother, and a man rightfully cursed. But he heard his mother's curse, and he, evidently fearing whatever conditions were made in that curse, confessed his crime and returned the stolen silver to his mother. His mother then blessed him, curiously. That tells us a few things about her. She is quick to both bless and to curse. She doesn't necessarily think about the outcome before she speaks. And not only that, but she is more concerned with appeasing her own faction than she is with establishing justice. She will let her son get away with anything, because he's one of her people. Anyone who wasn't on her team, she would have cursed, and she would have demanded restitution. But her son? She likes him. So instead of a curse, she gives him a blessing in the name of Jehovah. And that might be a sign of yet another problem. The third commandment says not to take Jehovah's name in vain, meaning not to use it to swear an oath which you will not fulfill. So if her curse was like her blessing, in that it was taken in Jehovah's name, we might also suppose that Micah's mother violated that commandment by using Jehovah's name in a flippant curse. And in thankfulness that her silver was restored, she took 200 of the pieces and devoted them to making an idol of Jehovah. This gives us yet another window into the character of the family. Obviously, to anyone who has studied through the Bible thus far, Jehovah detests idols, even if, and perhaps especially if, they're intended to represent him. So, despite her apparent zeal, Micah's mother shows herself to be ignorant about the most basic principles of the God whom she purports to serve. So right from the outset, we have a picture here of a family which surely displeases Jehovah. They are idolaters, abusers of God's name, dishonoring to parents, thieving, cursing. They're a rough lot, no doubt. And yet, despite the fact that they are obviously not in Jehovah's good graces, Micah keeps the idol and he sets up a shrine, a place of worship. And this isn't only a place of worship to the silver Jehovah idol, but a place of worship for other imagined gods as well, a violation of yet another of the Ten Commandments. And Micah goes through the rigors of making his little shrine seem legitimate. He gives one of his sons an ephod, which is a garment worn by the actual priests at the tabernacle, and he sets that son up as a priest. That also, we note, is very wrong. God had chosen only the descendants of Aaron the Levite, Moses' brother, to serve as his priests. So this was basically the worst church ever. Everything about it reeked of a complete ignorance of what pleases God. We've listed at least 5 of the 10 commandments being violated in only 5 verses, and beyond fundamental morals, they're getting the ceremony wrong as well. Verse 6 explains how such circumstances were possible. There was no king in Israel at that time, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Presumably Judges, or at least this ending portion of Judges, was written during the reign of either King Saul or King David. Both of them took at least some efforts to enforce the laws of God and the rule of the tabernacle, so a reader in their era would have probably found such a brazen action to be shocking, and this explanation would be necessary. In the age of the judges, of course, there was no king and thus no central enforcer of the morals, so if the community would sit back and allow someone to set up a terrible shrine like this, well, then he could get away with it. Micah's efforts to legitimize this little shrine did not stop at this, though. As the passage tells, a traveling Levite from Judah passed through the area and stopped with Micah. Now, if you didn't listen through the Torah, the Levites were one of the tribes of Israel, but they had been set apart for God's service. All priests were Levites, but not all Levites could be priests, and the Levites did not have their own tribal land, so the idea that a Levite might travel from place to place is not highly unusual, and neither is the idea that they had some particular connection to the worship of Jehovah. And for this reason, Micah hired him to serve as the priest of his shrine. This, yet again, was inappropriate. The man was a Levite, but not a priest. Micah supposed that ordaining the Levite would make his tabernacle more legitimate. He said, "Now I know that Jehovah will prosper me." Of course, he was wrong about that. In fact, it seems to me that this only made matters worse for him. First, he set up the sham shrine, and then he drew away one of God's actual servants to boot. And I'll note, the Levites' pay was room and board and 10 pieces of silver per year. Based on our earlier shekel estimate, this is the equivalent in silver of about $100. And that seems to suggest that these pieces of silver might have been bigger than shekels, because $100 in spending money for the year seems pretty paltry. But who knows? So, to give a recap of chapter 17, a really terrible family in Ephraim set up the worst shrine to Jehovah ever. And in chapter 18, the shrine starts to get some attention. We mentioned last week that the tribe of Dan had not taken possession of their land, and so here, we find the tribe looking for another land to possess. For this purpose, they appointed 5 spies to go through the land looking for a place. The spies started out at Zorah and Eshtaol, Danite towns on the far eastern side, close to the border with Judah. And it just so happened that as they traveled through, these spies stopped at Micah's shrine. The passage tells us that the spies recognized the voice of the Levite there. Perhaps they knew him personally. He had come from Judah, and they had come from that direction. Perhaps they had stayed there during their attempt to conquer their own tribal territory, or maybe they simply recognized his accent, marking him as a Levite. But whatever the case, they wanted to talk with him, apparently because they thought that he could inquire of God and determine how successful their voyage would be. So they asked him what he was doing there, and he explained the situation. And they asked him if their journey would be a prosperous one. The priest gave a favorable answer, that Jehovah would support them. And I suppose that the Levite turned out to be correct about that. However, I would guess that this was a matter of random chance. It seems unlikely that he could receive any divine guidance in his pitiful state, but this was a 50-50 proposition. There were only two outcomes, success for Dan or not success for Dan. He chose success and happened to be correct, at least temporally. So the spies went up and eventually found the city of Laish and decided to capture it. Laish is marked Dan on our interactive map. It is in the far north of Israel's allotted territory, close to the Jordan on the east side. The spies of Dan found that it would be easy to conquer, that the people there had no allies who would rescue them, and that this was a good and prosperous place to live. And so the spies of Dan returned to their tribe and encouraged them to go up and take Laish. Verses 11 through 13 record the Danites' preparation for war. They mustered their troops at Kiriath Jearim, and for this reason the place was colloquially called Mahane Dan, or the Camp of Dan, for some time thereafter. And then they took their small army of 600 men, accompanied by their families who would possess the city, and went on the march across Israel to Laish. On the way, they passed Micah's shrine. And then, in verses 14 through 21, they stole the entire shrine, priest and all. Evidently, it was the job of the Levite pseudo-priest to guard the place. So first, the spies, his friends whom he had met, went into the shrine, and then, while the Levite was distracted with the army standing at the gates, the spies looted the shrine of all its possessions, including especially the ephod and the various expensive idols. As they tried to leave with these things, the priest protested, but the Danites convinced him to come along with them. Better that he should be priest to an entire tribe than to the house of one man. The priest, obviously, was not very faithful to his post. He was more interested in the financial gain and the social notoriety than he was in anything. And so the shrine was stolen. Ironic, seeing that the entire shrine was started as a child of Micah's theft in the first place. While the Danites escaped with the loot, they prepared themselves to be attacked. They put their stolen goods and their children and livestock in the front of the march and put their soldiers in the back. They were ready to be chased down by Micah's reasonably angry people. And we should be left to shake our heads in some disbelief at this. This Danite army was mustered for the purpose of defeating the Canaanites, but instead they've looted their fellow Israelites, of idols no less, and now they're marching their children at the lead into enemy territory while defending themselves against their own people. It suggests to us that maybe the people of Israel in this case are the real danger and the people of Canaan are not, and that's a pretty bad position for Israel to be in. And then we can see how they ended up this way. Despite all the pretenses of worshiping Jehovah and seeking his guidance, throughout this story they've disregarded Jehovah's laws at every step of the way. Now, as the passage has told us, at that time there was no king. The king acted as a central executive authority, meaning he was the one who would enforce the laws. Under the law of Moses, there was no chief law enforcement, and indeed, no appointed law enforcement at all. This was a truly free people. And as a truly free people, they didn't need, or at least shouldn't have needed, an army of soldiers to protect them from each other. And as we have discussed, and as history has shown, these kinds of police forces tend to become less of a protection and more of a burden on the liberty of the people. For more on that topic from the Law of Moses, you could look at our message Enforcement Provisions in the Law of Moses from December 13th of 2017. But my point is this. If someone in Israel was robbed, there were no police to call. Instead, the burden of enforcing the laws fell to the individuals in the community, and so Micah, on finding the idols missing, rounded up a posse of the people near him, and they went off in pursuit of the Danites, and eventually caught up with them. But of course, it didn't go well for Micah. Dan had an army of 600 men. Micah had a posse of a handful of ill-prepared neighbors. They didn't have enough power to fight the Danites, and so unless the Danites had wanted to give the things back, they had no way to make them. For a moment, I feel sorry for Micah. Stealing is wrong, and so the Danites were in the wrong, but then again, Micah was also a thief, and the things that were stolen from him had been the reward of his theft. And being idols, they were things that he shouldn't have had anyway. This, unfortunately, is one of those stories in which there aren't any good guys. So Micah demanded his things back, and despite having the better claim, the soldiers of Dan told him to shut his mouth or be killed. Dan kept marching to Laish, and Micah turned around and went home. And thereafter, Dan conquered Laish. It was all too easy. The people of Laish had been unsuspecting. They had likely been hospitable to the Danite spies when they first came, never guessing that an army would end up at their door. They had no one nearby to help them. They were mercilessly slaughtered and their city was destroyed. Dan built a new city there and called it Dan. So, remember all those tribal allotments that we pored over for months and tediously drew on our maps? Well, Dan never took the territory allotted to them. They settled in this area instead. The map, you will recall, shows the ideal borders, but not what actually happened. Now, the city of Laish was populated by Canaanites, so there was no wrong in conquering that city. However, given the context of this narrative, it is hard to not feel sympathy for the people of Laish. The Israelites described in today's passage are the worst sort of people. Worshippers of false gods, idolaters, abusers of God's name, dishonorers of parents, thieves prepared to murder their own countrymen, backstabbers, money grubbers. There's virtually nothing good to be said of them, and every bad thing to be said, but the people of Laish are depicted with a sense of relative innocence and purity. They lived a quiet life in their city. They were separate from everyone else, and perhaps separate for a reason, to be separate from the practices of their neighbors. Their life was abundant. They were welcoming and naively unsuspecting. Again, they're Canaanites, so they're fair game, but it is hard not to sympathize with them. We recall that God's reason for commissioning Israel to destroy the Canaanites is that the Canaanites engaged in abhorrent practices in their pagan worship, while Israel was supposed to be a people pure in their worship. But here we have an uncomfortable feeling about these particular Canaanites being killed, because it seems that the roles were reversed. The people of Laish are just minding their own business and being friendly to outsiders, while the idolaters, the people of Dan, are sneaking up on them to stab them in the back. We're made to wonder whether the world is made worse when Dan has an inheritance and Laish has none. And that, I suppose, explains why God stopped Israel's conquest of the land as we discussed last week. He had once covenanted with them that they should take the land for the purpose of making it better. But now we see that they were making it worse. And so the deal just had to be called off. And so what had started as the worst possible shrine in one man's house became the religion of an entire tribe. The Danites set up the idol, they set up a false priesthood, and they lived as idolaters for many years to come. And in fact, Dan would be associated with idolatry forever after. Now, the exact time frame contemplated in this passage is uncertain because we don't know with any certainty when this passage was written. The passage says that the Danites engaged in this idolatrous worship until the day of the captivity of the land. Well, just when was that? Throughout the book of Judges, Israel would be ruled over by their neighbors at many times, so this could refer to any one of those, or several of them. Or perhaps this passage, or just this verse, was added in many years later, during or after Israel's Assyrian captivity. In that case, it would be telling us that Dan practiced their false religion for all of their history because Dan never came back after being taken as slaves to Assyria. But regardless of when exactly this passage refers to, it is clear that Dan did persist in idolatry at this city right up to the end. There were only two kings, David and Solomon, who solidified their control over all Israel. Whether or not they might have stamped out idolatry in Dan is unclear, particularly since Solomon engaged in idolatry himself. But after Solomon, the kingdom split, and the northern tribes, Dan included, fell into the kingdom of Jeroboam. Jeroboam, as you can read in 1 Kings 12, made the city of Dan into a hub of idolatry with the worship of a golden calf. That worship continued at the very least until the reign of King Jehu about a century later. We have it in 2 Kings 10:29 that Jehu failed to turn the people from this sin, and so evidently it continued thereafter. If ever the worship of the golden calf in Dan ceased, we have no record of that. And the tribe fell to Assyria within 200 years thereafter. It has been proposed that this history of idolatry even affected Dan right up to the end of the Bible, some 800 years after their final fall. In Revelation, the last book of the Bible, which I suppose we'll be studying in about 15 years if we ever get to it, there is a listing of the 12 tribes of Israel in chapter 7. But Dan's name is not mentioned. It is something of a mystery. Why was Dan left off the list? Some have proposed that this is why. From the first days of their independence, the tribe of Dan was engaged in idolatry, and the idolatry continued right up until their dissolution as a tribe. Dan and idolatry are basically synonymous. They don't deserve to be listed among God's people. And to contemplate a final curiosity from the passage, we have the priesthood of Dan's false religion. Verse 30 tells us that Jonathan, son of Gershom, son of Moses, became Dan's priest, with his sons taking the position after him. And it is a curiosity because it is unclear whether this descendant of Moses was the Levite in question. Prior to this point, the Levite was just a Levite, one who had been traveling from Judah. Does it turn out, though, that this Levite was Moses' own grandson? Or did the Danites, after establishing their religion, ultimately move on to hiring a priesthood with a little more clout? Well, unfortunately, we have limited information here. From other passages, we know that Moses had a son named Gershom, but we know little more than that about his descendants. So far as I know, this grandson Jonathan is mentioned nowhere else. And this passage only says what it says, that there was a Levite who became a false priest in Micah's house, and he went on with the Danites. Then the Danites installed Moses' grandson Jonathan as their priest. Are they the same person? I guess we don't know for certain, but it does seem to be the implication. Whether they are the same person or not, though, the tragedy remains. Moses was a great leader of Israel. His son, a contemporary of Joshua, presumably remained faithful. But in the third generation, with Joshua off the scene, even Moses' own grandson turned aside to a false religion. But then, that's only the case if this is Moses' grandson, and in fact, it may not be. Now, the English Standard Version, which is our go-to translation of the Bible, renders the text as Moses, as do many modern translations. But the King James and some others don't say Moses at all, but Manasseh. So which is it, Moses or Manasseh? And why do the translations have it so differently? First, note this. In English, Manasseh and Moses are spelled very differently. In Hebrew, not so much. In Hebrew, Moses' name is Moseh. Hebrew originally had no vowels, and without vowels, there's only one letter difference between Moseh and Manasseh. That one letter is a Hebrew nun, spelled N-U-N, if you were wondering. Our English translations of the Old Testament are taken from the Masoretic text, the ancient Old Testament text used by the Jews, and the Masoretic text does contain the character nun. However, it is a strange character. It has been superscripted, as if to highlight the fact that there is something strange about it. The tradition of the rabbis is that the nun was inserted so that in public readings of the passage the good name of Moses would not be sullied, and that the character was left superscripted to avoid confusion about whether or not it actually belonged there. And that tradition was accepted by some English scholars, strange as it is. Others, however, have disagreed, presuming instead that the nun must have been intentional and that it was only superscripted by a scribal slip of the pen, which was then perpetuated in later copies of the text. Well, which side is right? I suppose we can't know for certain. I do know, however, that whether it is Manasseh or Moses, it presents no real problem for believers. This is no matter of critical doctrine. If the passage does mention Manasseh, we might suppose that the head of Dan's priesthood was no Levite at all, and thus a different person from the former Levite mentioned. Then again, Manasseh, the tribal head, had no son named Gershom. So perhaps the Manasseh mentioned here was just some Levite who happened to have the common name Manasseh, and who happened to give his son the same name as Moses' son Gershom. I suppose we'll never know for certain, and sincere believers can accept either theory about the passage. I presume that the passage was intended to say Moses, but you are free to differ. So then that gets us through the passage. Judges 17 and 18 is the tragic story of Micah and the Danites in a generation that swerved from following Jehovah's laws. Micah was a man of ill repute who established a false religion and a false shrine and a false priesthood. And because his behavior was allowed to continue unchecked, it grew until it infected an entire group of people when the tribe of Dan adopted his false religion. And once it had taken root, this false religion remained strong among that people for their entire history until it destroyed them. It is a sad story, and one from which we can learn many lessons. So I hope that you'll join us next week when we consider those lessons. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.